Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets. My not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. To all of you with Irish blood and all that wish they were Irish, at least for today, happy St. Patrick's Day to all of you. Hope you're in shape enough to make it to work tomorrow. We've got a diverse but loaded program for you tonight. You've heard me a time or two interview a mobster or so on this program, organized crime figures who've done terrible things but tried to go straight, entered the witness protection program or whatever. In this hour, we see the story of the mafia from another angle. And in a way, it's a story that could be a metaphor for my hometown of Las Vegas. It's about the son of a mob-connected gambler from Chicago. All of his life, the son had to hear the whispers about his dad and his dad's colorful associates. What makes the son's story interesting is that he went on to become the top lawman in Clark County, where Las Vegas sits. Then he became lieutenant governor of Nevada, then governor, and served more years in that job than anyone in our state's history. You'll hear some people who think this is evidence that our entire state is corrupt, but the story told by former Governor Bob Miller is, I would say, one of redemption and perseverance. He ended up going after some of the most notorious mobsters of the 20th century and helped run most of them out of Las Vegas. Governor Bob Miller will join me in a few minutes to talk about those days, and I think it's a story that has appeal that stretches far beyond Nevada. Then in hour two, I am happy to welcome back to our program Dave Politis, the former police officer and forensic investigator whose pursuit of one strange mystery led him into something else entirely. An ongoing inquiry into the weird disappearances of hundreds of people, most of them in national parks or forests. I don't think there's any guest or subject that has generated more interest on the part of you Coast listeners since I've been hosting the show on Sunday nights. Dave is back with a third volume in his book series, Missing 411, and the new cases are every bit as strange as what we've heard before. We now know this mystery stretches beyond the borders of the U.S. into Canada and other countries as well. If you've heard our previous interviews on this topic, you know we're in for some hair-on-the-neck type stories. And if you haven't heard this before, strap yourselves in because it will be a long, spooky night. A couple of news stories I want to mention before we're joined by Bob Miller. First, a story about our friends on Wall Street, the big bad bankers. Are you following this inquiry underway in Washington into some of the latest abuses in the banking world? A congressional hearing focused this week on some of the egregious and risky errors made by banking giant, too big to fail, J.P. Morgan. Remember that story last year when they assured us they had made, a little error that cost them $1 billion or so, but it was no big deal, they said. Then we learned that it wasn't $1 billion, but it was a $2 billion mistake. Then it became a $3 billion error. Then $5 billion. And now it's known it was more than a $6 billion loss because of incredibly risky behavior. The kind of risk that banks took that sent the economy of the world into the toilet just a few years ago. We heard testimony on Thursday and Friday that the U.S. government had something like 70 regulators inside J.P. Morgan watching what they were up to. And there were another 40 overseers from the Federal Reserve that were supposedly watching the company as well. But none of those watchdogs saw anything amiss. And those few who had the temerity to ask questions of the bank were told by J.P. Morgan basically to buzz off. It doesn't exactly instill confidence in the rest of us out here in Podunkville on Main Street that another financial disaster couldn't be in the making. Instead, we have in Washington armies of banking lobbyists pushing for less and less regulation and less oversight. Because, that's just what we need. Let the banks be banks and get off their backs. We know how that worked out the last time. Makes you wonder who's the regulator and who's the regulated. Second news story. Federal appeals court has ruled the CIA has to quit playing games with its killer drone program. CIA went to court to block the release of any records related to its use of drones to kill people. It's argued that the very existence of these kind of records would endanger national security, and that it's bad for the CIA to even admit it knows anything about the drone program. Preposterous, the court panel ruled. The CIA's use of drones isn't exactly a big secret. In fact, it's ridiculous to even argue something like that. So the case is headed back to a lower court where the CIA will look for some other strategy to use in denying what just about everyone in the world who can read a newspaper already knows. Third story, an outcome that is also at least temporarily encouraging. A federal judge in California has ruled that the FBI needs to justify its use of something called national security letters. Basically, these letters are a tool the FBI has used to spy on people. Essentially, the Bureau has to file one of these secret letters that says so-and-so is a suspected terrorist, and then the feds have all kinds of freedom to spy and eavesdrop, follow them around, whatever. But the judge found the FBI has been egregiously misusing this authority, not even going through the barest motions to justify the letters it's been issuing. So at least temporarily, the FBI is going to have to rethink its use of this tool. And is it so bad to have at least a tiny smidgen of justification before tossing the Fourth and Fifth Amendments in the trash? I mean, shouldn't there be at least some verifiable reason given in secret to a court before they launch something like this against American citizens who may have absolutely nothing to do with terrorism? Final news story. We all read about the latest success of the Mars rover program. I posted a recent story in our NAPS news section tonight on the Coast to Coast website. The rover, as many of you know, did some soil tests up there on Mars and found that life could have existed on Mars somewhere in the past based on chemical analysis of the dirt. NASA, of course, stopped far short of saying they had found actual evidence of life. And the reason is because they admit, and you'll read it in this story we posted, they admit they didn't send any equipment for confirmation of actual life in the soil. They only included equipment that could tell us if the building blocks of life are there. Now, why in the world do you spend all that money to send a craft all the way to Mars to look for the building blocks of life, but not include equipment to look for actual life? You know what I think? I mean, NASA doesn't really want to know the answer. At least they don't want to know the answer right now. So maybe they're going to drag it out for another 20 years before someone gets the bright idea to send a rover to Mars, which has the same kind of equipment that we sent to Mars back in the 1970s. Lex and I have put together our usual eclectic mix of strange news items from the recent past in the NAPS news section on the Coast website. Check it out when you get a moment. We now take our first break and come back with Nevada's longest serving governor, Bob Miller, to talk about his life in the shadow of the mob. It's going to be fun. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. Bob Miller is Nevada's longest serving governor. Before that, though, he was a peace officer, a prosecutor, a judge. He was a DA for Clark County. He chaired the National DA's Association, then became lieutenant governor, served 10 years as governor of Nevada, which is a record that will never be broken because of term limits. Went on to be chairman of the National Governors Association. Governor has written written a new book called Son of a Gambling Man, and unlike a lot of political memoirs, this one's not boring at all. It's filled with Damon Runyon-type characters from Bob Miller's life. Governor, great to have you on the show.
Nice to talk to you, George.
You know, well, let's start with a cliche. You've heard it all your life, as I have, my time in Las Vegas, that Las Vegas was a much better town when the mob ran things. As a former lawman, I'm sure that makes you bristle to think the mob ever ran it. But you know what that cliche refers to. It's a time when people like your father ran the casinos on the Strip, and it was a heck of a time.
Well, it was, but I believe that was because it was a smaller community, and everybody knew everybody else. It wasn't corporate America like it is now. It was kind of handshakes. And I don't really believe that the mob ran Las Vegas in the context that a lot of people think. I mean, we had very effective law enforcement. We had guys like Ralph Lamma as the sheriff, who is the person depicted in the TV show Vegas, and he made sure that the streets were safe, et cetera. The mob, if they had some influence, it was in financing in the hotels, and it really wasn't involved in street-level criminals.
The story you tell in this book, Son of a Gambling Man, and by the way, I really enjoyed it. It's a lot of fun to read. is sort of a metaphor for Las Vegas, as you note. It's a city of second chances, which it was a city of second chances for your family, certainly.
Yeah, I believe that's the case. And, you know, it's the transition of my family parallels the transition in the city of Las Vegas. You know, we had a railroad stop once upon a time. It evolved to Bugsy Siegel coming in. The era in which you could say there were, you know, was certainly mob domination, if certainly mob influence existed in the casinos, that was eradicated through effective law enforcement, federal, state, and local, combined with just a change in the economics, bringing in corporations, people like Kirk Coring coming in, people you know, like the Hilton Corporation coming in, and that evolved eventually to what we have today, you know, mega corporations that are publicly traded. And individuals that are running them come from Wall Street. They don't come from bookie joints like my dad.
Well, let's talk about your dad. Introduce him to our audience. He ran in an interesting crowd there in Chicago.
He did. He was a person who was a bookie. At least that's what he was most of his life that I knew of, when he was about 30, I believe, and beyond. And he ran a bar burlesque place that had a bookie joint in the back, which I didn't really know until much later in my life after my father died. Because of that, obviously had to deal with people who were in the criminal element, because you know, they had their influences, as it would be. He eventually, in 1955, when I was about 10 years old, got an opportunity to buy in the Riviera Hotel in Las Vegas and moved the family out here. And that was characteristic of all the casino owners in that era, because, again, we were a very small town. It was gaming was not held in the esteem that it is now, and no one, in a conventional sense, banking or financial institutions, were investing any money in gaming. The money came from the Teamsters Central States Pension Fund. That was about the only source extraneous of the individuals themselves, and so the individuals that came in to run it were people like my dad, who knew how to run gaming establishments, and if that was the case, they'd done it elsewhere, and if they'd done it elsewhere, it was illegal. And so my dad was just one of many of those people who came out to live a different life, to become respectable people in the community, and I think he achieved all that in his lifetime.
I know it's hard for people in other parts of the country to accept that people could be illegal gamblers, illegal bootleggers, or mob associates somewhere else, and then come to Las Vegas and be respectable citizens, but that's pretty much how it worked out.
It was the case, and it's a part of our history that, you know, you can't change it. You just have to recognize it. It was what was necessary for Las Vegas to grow. As I said, there was not an economic incentive for individuals to come out and build $2 billion hotels in that era. It was mostly desert. Desert was in between the hotels. There weren't that many of them. It was a windy, dusty little place, and not a lot of tourists were coming here at that point in time. So the only people who were going to do it were gamblers, who said, you know, we're going to go where it's legal. And, you know, we know how to do it. We'll make a different life for ourselves out there.
As a lawman, of course, you learned later a lot about how the mob worked and mob associations, what that meant. You ever ask yourself about, I know you realize, and you detail it in the book, that your dad had associations there, whether or not there were hidden arrangements, or that he had to pay tribute or anything like that to do business?
Well, I'm certain, you know, that those things are possible, and they certainly occurred from wiretaps. We learned it from other hotels. As I indicate in the book, my father was once indicted, actually, on those type of charges, not to suggest where the money was going, but to suggest that it wasn't being reported to federal income tax. But the prosecutors themselves dismissed the charges against him, so I take that on face value, having been a prosecutor, that, you know, if you aren't convicted, you aren't convicted. But so I don't dwell on it. I don't look back on it and worry about it. I know that my father was never convicted of any crime, to my knowledge, and I know the type of civic-minded person he was when he came to Las Vegas, and you know, that's the person I choose to remember. But of course, he was my father.
Your family came here in the mid-1950s, and of course, I wasn't here, and I'm jealous about that. I didn't get here till late 70s, right about the time you became a district attorney. But I think of that period, 1955 through the 1960s, as sort of the golden age of Las Vegas, when the town was really coming into its own, golden age for entertainment, mobsters and cowboys and nuclear scientists at the test site. It was a really interesting period. Is that how you remember it? It certainly is how you describe a lot of it.
We were a real potpourri. There's a book about the local, one of the local golf courses, Las Vegas Country Club, and in it, Irwin Mulaski, a local businessman, said that it was an amazing place because you go there for lunch and you'd see people like Modelas, who was reputed to be, you know, from a mobster background from Cleveland, and at the next table you'd see maybe Shecky Green, a famous entertainer, and then you'd see the sheriff, and then you'd see, you know, the banker, and so on, and everybody mixed together in the same places. You know, Ralph Lamb, I think, who was the sheriff, as I said, was one who put it succinctly in how he approached it, the era. And that was he really wasn't concerned about what somebody had done before they came to Las Vegas. He was concerned about what they were doing that day and what they would do in the future. And as long as they minded their P's and Q's and they weren't, you know, here to create any problems, that was fine with him. And so, again, it was the land of second chances.
For you, as going into politics, elected official, you, as you detail in the book, you had to deal with your father's legacy pretty much at every step of your political career. Somebody would drag it up and try to smear you with it, even though, as you explain your personal history, your father made a point of making it clear that that was not going to be your life. You weren't going to be a casino guy. You were going to be something else.
Yeah, we weren't even allowed to have a deck of cards in the house. You know, he really wanted me going a different direction. My father was, you know, a high school graduate through GED, and education was very important to him. He actually worked in a law firm for a short while. In those days, you didn't have to go to law school, but he wasn't able to stick with it, and I think he always would have liked to have been a lawyer. So he wanted me to be one, and it made it evident from the beginning that I was going to definitely go to college and hopefully go to law school, both of which did occur. And he wanted me, you know, in a different realm, different life than he'd led. Ironically, at the present time, I'm on the board of the Wynn Resorts and International Game Technology that makes gaming devices. So it's come full circle, but I'm in a different gaming world than the one my father lived in.
Well, we'll talk about some of the specific races when you had to deal with the stories in a minute. I wanted to get into how your father came to be at the Riviera, which, you know, it's still open for business on the Strip, maybe past its prime a little bit, but when it opened, it was a pretty fabulous place, and he was partners with some interesting characters.
That he was.
Can you give us some of those names?
Well, probably the most famous was a man named Gus Greenbaum, and Gus Greenbaum supposedly had ties to Chicago organized crime. He and another individual walked in the day after the day after Bugsy Siegel was murdered. They walked into the Flamingo and said, "We're in charge," and nobody argued with them. So they ran the Flamingo for a while. Gus Greenbaum retired, then he came back into the Riviera Hotel, ostensibly to represent the interests of a Chicago mobster named Tony Accardo at the time. He was reluctant at first, and then as facts go, and you can surmise from it, his sister was murdered. He changed his mind, came to the Riviera. But he had a reputation for not handling finances real well, drinking a lot, you know, doing things that were not in the best interest of his partners, his maybe hidden partners. And he and his wife were ultimately murdered in their beds in Phoenix, Arizona. You know, others...
Davey Berman,
who had a reputation of being supposedly a murderer at times. His daughter, Susan, who was a few years older than me, indicated in some of her books, she was a writer, you know, about her dad's background, and that she lived in the shadow of that, much like I had, but she didn't hold any public office. Davey Berman died relatively young, but in a somewhat natural cause. He died on an operating table here in Las Vegas.
There was a guy named Red Dorfman who was a key to not only the Riviera, I guess, but to a lot of casinos in Las Vegas. And then his son became key as a conduit for Teamster money, right?
That's exactly right.
And your dad knew Red?
He was a friend of Red Dorfman, for sure. And Red Dorfman is alleged by some accounts, a lot of which I've received only recently, but by some accounts of being a link between the Teamsters Union and organized crime during the Hoffa era. And Red Dorfman came out to visit occasionally when we first came out here. He may have been the person that helped my dad find his opportunity to buy in the Riviera. I'm not sure. I don't have the facts one way or the other. Red Dorfman ultimately died, and his son, Alan Dorfman, took up that role. And he was kind of like a landlord out here because he was the person that was facilitating Teamster loans to the hotels, and they all needed it to survive. So he was here. He was kind of accepted when he came around, although I suspect, you know, there were certain intelligence gathering would have indicated that he had a suspicious background. Alan Dorfman himself was ultimately murdered in Chicago.
We'll get back into that. Former Governor Bob Miller, author of the new book, Son of a Gambling Man, is my guest. A lot of colorful characters still to come here on Coast to Coast. We're looking at the life of former Nevada Governor Bob Miller, whose new book, Son of a Gambling Man, is not only the story of his personal odyssey through the political world, but also is a metaphor for Las Vegas itself, how it shed its mob past to become what it is today. We continue our conversation talking about some of the colorful characters the governor has known in his life right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with former Nevada Governor Bob Miller, whose new book, Son of a Gambling Man, is already climbing up the bestseller lists. And Governor, I was wondering as I read this, you know, while your father was alive, you make the point in the book, you didn't really talk to him about this stuff, about his past associations or his business, did you?
No. Any conversation with my father was always one that he initiated, and he didn't want me to be any part of the gaming world. He was kind of a quiet person. He just worked hard and tried to improve the quality of life for the family through that, but he wasn't going to share anything with us.
So I wonder, in writing the book, all the research that you have to do into his background, I mean, you had to learn a lot of things you didn't know before. Was it painful to confront this stuff, or a catharsis?
Well, I look at it as probably a combination. I learned elements of associations that were a little beyond what I had known previously. But again, I look at what's on face value, and I knew the man. I knew what he was like in Las Vegas. I knew that there's people here, the prominent bankers, the sheriff, other gaming people that speak highly of my dad during the years he was out here. I don't really know a lot of detail about what he did when he was in Chicago or I believe in Detroit prior to that. So, that's always going to remain a mystery to me, I suppose. So, it was a mixed bag, I suppose, putting it together.
I thought one of the most moving statements in the book came from a banker named Perry Thomas, who was sort of the banker that helped put Las Vegas together. He became the banker who organized and allocated loans from the Teamsters Pension Fund, and he had some things to say about your dad. Can you share those?
Yes, Perry was very positive about my dad. He said that he was a person who, when he said something, he did it. He was very dependable. He was congenial. Easy to work with. He compared him and a man named Carl Cohen from the Sands Hotel. As he said, they were the two best people in all of Las Vegas in that era. And as you said, Perry, along with a man named Jerry Mack, were the first to kind of bring in some conventional financing through Valley Bank. So Perry is and was very well known. People that follow UNLV basketball probably would recognize the last name, at least, because they play their games in the Thomas and Mack Stadium, named after those two individuals.
There's a scene in the Godfather, and you reference it in the book, in which Marlon Brando as Don Corleone, he tells his son Michael, you know, this life isn't what I wanted for you. I wanted you to be Governor Corleone, Senator Corleone. You have had to deal with that your whole life, your whole political life anyway, the insinuation that you must be connected because your dad had friends.
Well, that's the exact reason of the title of the book. It's the day that I was, or day before I was sworn in as governor, the Washington Post wrote a story. And in that story, they began with that quote from Brando, et cetera, and said, what are we to make of Bob Miller, et cetera? it was eye-catching, of course, but thereafter, it pointed out my extensive law enforcement background, the fact that I'd been the president of the National District Attorneys Association, worked on crime victim rights, been selected by President Ronald Reagan to deal with a nine-person task force to deal with crime victims, et cetera, and had strong support of law enforcement. Balance it out. But the headline of the story was Son of a Gambling Man, and thus the title of the book.
So it's almost like giving them a chin gesture or something like that right back at the Washington Post. Before that story, there was another story that really was hard-hitting, and you mentioned that in the book as well. It's from the San Jose Mercury. And this is really, I think the story was aimed at somebody other than you, but you were used as the instrument of it. Tell us about that.
Well, we had a United States senator named Chick Heck, who had been ranked the least effective member of the U.S. Senate during his one term in the U.S. Senate. But he had strong financial backing, particularly from certain elements of the Republican Party, because he voted solidly. He was facing an election challenge from the governor, Dick Bryan, and Dick preceded me as governor, so I was lieutenant governor. The Heck campaign didn't know, what they were going to do. They ran two ads. One was related to the state jet. The other one was Bob Miller is unsuitable to be governor of the state of Nevada. So he kind of loaded me into his gun and was attacking me throughout it. And his purpose wasn't to stop me from winning an election because I was in midterm. It was to hopefully stop Dick Bryan from defeating him on the basis that people wouldn't vote for Dick Bryan for fear that Bob Miller would become governor. Ultimately, that is what happened. Dick Bryan defeated Chick Heck. But what precipitated it in part is that after this was going on for a while, I said, this is crazy. I'm not going to let them, destroy my name, and I'm not going to let them tarnish my family's name. So I called a press conference, and I had the sheriff, the district attorneys from both parts of the state, Reno and Las Vegas. I also had a retired former FBI agent who had been the head of the organized crime strike force in Las Vegas during the era in which we're talking about. And then he was the chief staff person on the president's task force on organized crime. I thought he was the most impacted because he spoke about wiretaps extensive that were going on in Kansas City and Chicago, and that I wasn't a blip on anybody's radar. But the line that caught the headlines was by the sheriff of Las Vegas, who said, if Bob Miller's mafia, so is the Pope.
Why didn't it work? I mean, it came up when you, I think when you ran for Justice of the Peace the first time, it came up when you ran for District Attorney. Why didn't that tactic ever work? We look at campaigns now, and the tiniest little tidbit can be blown way out of proportion and can be very effective in negative campaigning. Why didn't it stick with the voters of Las Vegas and Nevada?
Well, in the first place, most of the time it was not against me. I mean, it was trying to bootstrap attacks on me related to my father or, people that my father had done some business with at one time or another. There were rare instances when I'd written a letter on behalf of one individual who was convicted of crime, in which I didn't recommend the sentence. I just said, I'd seen another side of him as well that should be considered. But other than that, it was always trying to insinuate the guilt by association, far removed. My father died before I ever held any political office, and I didn't really have any relationships with any of these individuals, extraneous of them being friends of my father. And then I had strong law enforcement support. I'd come up through law enforcement, and I'd done a lot of things in law enforcement. I'd been very aggressive as district attorney in going after Tony the Ant Sinatra, who people would recognize from Joe Pesci's role in the movie Casino. I'd work with the feds on that, and as I said, I'd been selected by the president on crime victims and dealt with the national district attorneys, had gotten the recommendation from my peers to be president of that association. So we had a strong counter for it, and that, was what was necessary almost in every instance.
Let's talk about that casino period. You became district attorney of Clark County in 1978. And that's right about the time I got there. I was in court a lot, covered a lot of these hearings. Seemed like there was one every other day for Tony Spilotro or any of his crew, the Hole in the Wall gang, or a hearing about Lefty Rosenthal and his gaming licenses. Those are the guys whose real life story are told in that movie. When you became DA, did you pretty much know about those guys, or did you go into a briefing one day and here's the secret files, here's the deal on these guys?
In reality, nothing like that exactly occurred. I mean, a general idea of who they were, and they certainly had a reputation that almost everybody in the community was aware of in one fashion or another. But as a prosecutor, for the most part, we were dealing with street crime, so we weren't dealing in the intelligence component of it to a large degree. We did to some degree, but not extensively like the federal government was doing. Where we were very effective is in Spilotro branching out into street crimes, and he had a lot of his lieutenants who were this hole in the wall gang, which was entitled such because what they would do is break in through the wall to avoid the alarm systems. And they were caught in one instance at a furniture store, and we were able to work with the feds to help turn some of them into witnesses, you know, which ultimately brought in the downfall of some of the gang members. And Splatter himself was murdered, ostensibly, or you know, probably because he was creating too many problems for organized crime individuals back east, that too much notoriety, et cetera. So we were able to help put on the pressure there.
That was something different. He was something different, as Joe Pesci says in the movie, you know, a real-life gangster in town. Whereas the old-time gangsters who bought into casinos during your father's era wanted to keep trouble out of Las Vegas. They took care of a lot of problems before they got out of hand. This guy caused problems. He branched out. He enacted street taxes and got into drugs and loan sharking, all sorts of things. And really, his issues became the downfall of the mob, or at least contributed to it, don't you think?
I think they had a lot to do with it. I mean, he did not own a hotel, for example. You know, I don't know what purpose he was out here for, or who'd sent him out here, but in any case, when he did come here, he went to basic street crime. And that, if you listen to accounts from law enforcement, et cetera, from various sources over the years, Las Vegas in that era was kind of like an open city that anybody from other parts of the country that wanted to come out here and try and be involved in gaming, you know, could do so. But that it was not one that you were going to have turf wars in, or that you were going to be involved in raising the profile related to those prior associations or present associations. He didn't follow those rules. And, you know, ultimately, he and his brother were murdered, buried in a farm, I think, in Indiana.
Spilotro was Mr. Outside, Mr. Inside, at least that was the story we all heard, was Lefty Rosenthal, who in the Casino movie was played by Robert De Niro. Did you have any interaction with him?
I did not, but I mean, I knew who he was. He was on television. He had his own TV show. He kind of flaunted the Gaming Regulatory Authority. He flaunted state government at the time because he, too, was supposedly not an owner in the Stardust Hotel where he was. But if you went in there on a regular basis, especially the federal government was watching, and even the state government, you know, you couldn't get anything done without his approval. And, you know, he could do whatever he wanted in the property. So all the signs of his ownership were there, except that he wasn't licensed. And when the state started coming after him to potentially be licensed as a key employee, et cetera, he started rebelling and going on TV and having his own TV show and raising a very high profile, which I'm sure was not to the liking of anybody else he was associated with either, because you know, he was kind of spitting in the face, so to speak.
Your prosecutors, you and your prosecutors, went after Spilotro and his gang on a variety of different kinds of charges. Some of them, you made them stick. I don't think you ever nailed Spilotro or convicted him before he was murdered. But as you confront he, and as gaming authorities confronted Lefty, they had to deal with a guy named Oscar Goodman, and who became, amazingly enough, the mayor of Las Vegas, and one of the most popular mayors, easily the most popular mayor we've ever had. His story is similar to yours in some ways.
Well, it's similar in and it's different. Oscar started out as a defense attorney, and he was a few years older than me. He was a very good defense attorney, and when I was a young deputy DA going into court, when I knew when Oscar was on the other side, I'd better be prepared. He was a very good speaker, very intelligent guy. He also had a woman who worked with him, Manette Quintana, who was a very good researcher, so the motions were fast and furious when you're dealing with him. He branched out from that beginning where he was originally representing alleged criminals and criminals that were committing street crime, so to speak, and he I don't know what was the first step, but he then started representing reputed individuals in organized crime, including Spilotro and Meyer Lansky and people that were very well known. So he was their defense attorney for many years, and ultimately retired, ran for mayor of Las Vegas, and was elected, and reelected, and reelected. Now his wife's the mayor. He was term limited. His wife, Carolyn, is the mayor. I told him the other day, I said the word Goodman is synonymous with mayor, apparently. You know, Oscar's a colorful person, speaks out, you know, and he certainly creates attraction, and you know, that's kind of similar to Las Vegas. We're a city that is kind of glitzy and attracts people.
I think that Las Vegas has become what it is. This it's always been great, but I don't think even anyone could have seen what it would become, these glittering palaces. But it had to happen that the mob had to go. I mean, that was a painful exorcism that you helped carry out, the kind of period that we talked about in the movie Casino. Painful, though, right?
It was, a transition, and it occurred in various stages. And elements have occurred from law enforcement we've discussed now. Elements that occurred in transition in financial ownership, as I mentioned earlier, the Hilton Corporation coming in, giving us a corporate legitimacy that we hadn't had previously, evolving from Kirk & Corning coming in, building properties, and then Steve Wynn with high interest bonds in connection with Michael Milken, had developed the first mega property on the Strip, the newer one other than Caesar's Palace, newest one, and from there built a lot of those type of hotels during the years that I was governor. It was kind of a flourishing decade when I was governor as far as building, and they were corporations that ultimately became public corporations. So it was a real metamorphosis during that time frame. Organized crime, it really outgrew them, as well as the pressure became too much for them to bear.
I think the episode that came closest to sullying your reputation, and it would have been unfair if it did, was involved a guy named Carl Thomas, who was pretty close to your father and who it turned out was one of the architects of the mob skim from casinos. Tell us who he was and why it was a painful episode for you.
He was an individual that my father had met in the Las Vegas Shrine Club. My father was the president of the Shrine Club one year and had to do some public speaking. He turned to Carl Thomas, who had been a card dealer in one of the hotels, was another member who helped him prepare his public speaking. He liked him, and so he brought him in with him to the Riviera Hotel and ultimately the Circus Hotel. When my father sold the Circus Hotel, his part of it anyhow, he and Carl Thomas owned 50-50 this little place in front called the Slots of Fun. My father died, and it was only after my father died that Carl Thomas then had roles in different hotels, unrelated to our family, the Stardust Hotel, Tropicana Hotel. And eventually, he was caught on a wiretap in Kansas City in the house of an alleged mafia chieftain, Nick Sevilla. And he had mentioned my name in it. He went in, or not by title at least. He said, I had breakfast with the district attorney, newly elected at that time, great kid or something like that. I was younger than him. Fortunately for me, that wasn't the end of the conversation. As they continued to banty, Sevilla or someone else in his ilk spoke up and said, well, did we want him? Did we support him? And Carl said, oh, God, no, you didn't want him. You supported the other guys.
Oh, that's great.
That was fortuitous in some respects. And Carl was ultimately convicted, but he then turned state's evidence or federal evidence against some of the others. He was never, as I looked at it, there was no indication he was ever a violent person, but he was associating with people who had a reputation for violence and helping design ways that they could take some money out of the hotels and get it back to them personally, both at the Tropicana and the Stardust. As I said, this was after my father died and so on. But I'd known him, obviously, because he'd worked for my dad, and when my dad died, he went by to my mother's house every single day. He treated her as if she was almost his own mother, just to make sure she was okay. So when he was sentenced, I had written a letter saying that, look, I gave my own background. I said, I'm not recommending a sentence. By no means am I condoning or excusing anything he's done on a criminal basis. But, when you're sentencing, you need to know all the facts, and I would just make you aware of the fact that, I've never seen him be violent in any fashion, and he certainly, took good care of my mother, who was a lonely widow at the time. I said, use that as you might. And that was ultimately used against me as well.
Well, I remember when that story broke, and I think everybody in town was pretty much shocked. This guy was an up-and-comer, straight arrow, as far as anyone knew. It was quite a shock. I should mention to the audience, your son, Ross, named for his grandfather, is now Secretary of State in Nevada. Has anybody tried to tar him with the same brush, or is it too far removed?
I hope and believe it's too far removed. he's in his second term as Secretary of State, and he's the president of the National Association of Secretaries of State. So, you know, Ross himself, like myself, was a prosecutor before he held public office. And it hasn't been an issue in his campaigns. It was certainly used numerous times against myself, unsuccessfully. But Ross was never alive at the same time that his grandfather was. So,
Governor Bob Miller, author of the new book, Son of a Gambling Man, I really appreciate you coming on the show. I enjoyed the book. I hope people will check it out.
I hope so, too. They can find it on Amazon or Apple or Barnes & Noble.
We've got links on our website as well. Governor, thanks very much for joining us. Coming up next, Dave Politis to talk about missing 411. Stay with us.